I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. My sobriety date is January the 5th of 1990. Today is obviously March 17th of 2017. You might notice I'm from a little north of here, so you might pick that up as I throw out certain words. But where I come from, I mean, I don't know what people do down here on St. Patrick's Day. You know, where I come from, people don't even like the term St. Paddy's Day. We don't use that term. We say Patrick's. And where I come from, it's not a day. It's kind of a season. It's already been going on for about 4 weeks, and it ends sometime around Easter, you know. And everything in that period is kind of St. Patrick's Day, for lack of a better understanding of that. And if you're new here tonight, I want to welcome you. If I say anything that you don't like, you're probably right and I'm wrong. So I'll say that right from the beginning. You know, when you speak often, you start to hear certain things. So I'll clue you in. Here's the one thing I know. That is all pockets of people inside AA. There's the people who say you didn't talk about God enough. There's the people who say you didn't talk about the steps enough. There's the people who say you didn't talk about the book enough. People who say you didn't talk about service enough. But regardless of any of that, what I know, because I've been to quite a lot of AA events, and I'm not talking about from up here. I'm talking about sitting in the back. And here's what I know about AA speaker events. That if I'm sitting towards the back and I'm watching people leave at a convention or a conference, someone can come right by me and they'll be talking to the guy next to him saying, that's the worst, I won't even use the word, speaker I've ever heard in my life. Who chose him to speak? How did they ever put him on the program? What were they thinking? And then just as he's passing me, 10 feet later, will come another guy or woman in tears talking to the person next to him, who says, that's the greatest speaker I ever heard. And says, how did they know I was going through that? So I recognize, because I'm as judgmental as can be, that we are judgmental a lot. We just are. But I can only share my experience, and you know, my experience is just about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not ashamed to scream from the rooftops that I believe if you have alcoholism, you can get sober through Alcoholics Anonymous, through the program that's laid out in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I admit that, you know, it's hard for me. I just did the math so I wasn't wrong. You know, I came to my first AA meeting as a teenager in ninth grade. I got sober at 23. So that means, give or take, based on my age today, which is still hard for me to recognize, that I've been around you people for 71% of my life, right? From age 15 to now. So I definitely have my view on AA. And I'm not afraid to admit that sometimes that's not popular. Or it sounds like it's outdated or old-fashioned. I read all the news, I see what's going on social media, but I don't think AA is outdated or old-fashioned. I think it works as good today as it worked on Mother's Day of 1935. I'm convinced of that, and I'm not afraid to talk about it. You know, my life is not like it once was. I mean, tonight, the exciting part of my day today was listening to Led Zeppelin driving on the way here, right? That's about as exciting as my life gets today, right? Maybe the Sandy Springs police will catch me. The last time I got pulled over, it was for paying my American Express corporate account while stopped at a red light. That was a couple of months ago, so I'm not perfect by any means. But that's about as wild as my life gets today, you know? Paying my American Express bill, pulling out of the bank because I have another business trip coming on. That's not how I showed up here. I showed up to my first meeting in Levi dungarees, black boots, some type of heavy metal t-shirt, Levi dungaree jacket with an Ozzy Osbourne oil painting on the back of it, In the winter, I had a green olive drab three-quarter length jacket that had the WHO Quadrophenia symbol painted on the back of it. And I left the school every day and grabbed a pack of Marlboro Reds and shoved them down the front of my pants and faced the day and whatever it had to come. And that's how I showed up to my first meeting. And I have this period of 8 years where I was in and out of AA. And, you know, there's the other crowd that you run into. I don't need to hear your drunkalog. Or then the people who say, did you even drink, right? I mean, how do you keep everybody happy in Alcoholics Anonymous? I go by a rule that I heard a great Al-Anon speaker say a long time ago. I have not seen her in a long time. I'm not a member of Al-Anon. But there was a speaker named Mary Pearl. I forget the initial of her last name. But she always used to say from the podium, the newcomer will never want your solution if they don't first know that you definitely have their problem. They're not going to believe what you have to say. They're not going to believe that you're armed with the facts. They need to understand that you were where they are and that you found a way out. And so I have no problem talking about drinking in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it seems kind of crazy to me that we would even debate that, but in AA we'll debate anything, so why not debate whether we should talk about drinking? So I'm not afraid to admit that I love to drink. I love everything about drinking. I know that other people drank differently than me. That's okay too. But I love to drink. And where I grew up, everybody loves to drink. And I come from, you know, I have three siblings. So we have four children. One passed away, so we would have had five. My mom comes from seven. My dad comes from seven. My mom from nine. So I have 42 first cousins. And a lot of alcoholism. A lot of alcoholism. At a period of time in the 70s and early 80s where people didn't talk about alcoholism. And people had lots of code words about problems in your family, but never would anyone attach it to drinking. And if you have 42 first cousins, that means you spend a lot of time going to other people's houses, to christenings and confirmations and first communions and graduations. And, you know, all of those from a young age I saw end badly. There's no party in my family that ends good. That's just kind of a rule. And I wish I could say that has most of all stopped, but every once in a while it still happens today. And maybe I'll get to a good story about that. But they all end like a cops episode. You know, and I'm sure you know what that looks like. That means there are kids who should have been to bed a lot earlier, who are half in their pajamas and half in the clothes they had on that day. And there are men and women fighting with each other about who will drive home. And I'm not shy about where I come from or dishonest about how I was raised. In fact, I would find it intellectually and spiritually dishonest not to be honest. I don't come from some kind of diverse community. I don't come from some family who believes in embracing all different cultures, okay? I don't come from a family where the 12 steps are like you're giving them as a way to live better with the community. In fact, I tell people all the time that a good sign that you might belong here is if those 12 things on the wall are 180 degrees opposite of your DNA. If you look at those 12 suggestions and they are entirely opposite, I either have some good or bad news for you, depending upon what you really want to hear or what you consider good or bad news. But if believing in God and taking your own inventory and making amends and all that stuff sounds good to you, then I probably would be suspect. If you tell me that that sounds like a lot of garbage that you're never willing to do, then I have some news for you. You probably belong here. Now, that doesn't make you here, and I want to be clear on that. I'm not a person who doesn't believe that the 12 steps can help everybody. But there's something much more important than those 12 principles that are required for us to be here. And that is to be an alcoholic. actually on page 21 of the big book, to be a real alcoholic. But when I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean that I'm a real alcoholic. I don't need to say real every time. If you knew me 15 years ago, I probably said real every time, but I don't need to say real every time. But I know what a real alcoholic is. You know, it means clearly that I can't safely take one drink. And when I do, my body tells me I have to have another. Now, that happened long before you could say I was addicted to alcohol or alcohol dependent or anything like that. I simply suffer from the allergy that is laid out in the doctor's opinion and more about alcoholism. When I take one drink, the compulsion inside me is so strong that regardless of what happened the night before, the month before, the year before, my body tells me I have to keep drinking. And then worse than that, the next day, now, my wife is here and she would tell you I've been forced to become an early riser, but I am not an early riser by design, okay? In my chosen career and profession, yes, I get up early, but I've never liked getting up early. In fact, the term 12 and 12, that's the way I used to sleep, you know, 12 up, 12 down. It makes perfect sense to me, that kind of sleep pattern. And I like to wake up really between 4:30 and 6:30 p.m. That is my preferred waking up time. And I like to reach to the night table and hopefully there is at least one cigarette there with one implement to light it with, whether it be matches or a lighter. But just can I get one cigarette as I wake up and face another disastrous day? And then stumble out to some 7-Eleven or Dunkin' Donuts and get a cup of coffee or an iced tea and maybe a chocolate bar and a new pack of cigarettes. And that at least life seems bearable until about another hour or two, where I become completely uncomfortable in my own skin. And then worse than that compulsion is the obsession that I have of the mind. Because my mind tells me, even if I woke up in a place that required my mother to come and post some money for me to leave, even if that happened, it doesn't matter what happened the night before or the week before. My brain tells me the only way to feel comfortable in my own skin is to start the insanity all over again. And when you've been coming to AA since you've been 15 or 14 years old, I mean, you hear a lot of things. You know, the first drink gets you drunk. Well, I use that as a reason to believe I didn't belong in AA. Like, I'm one of those people, there's a... I'll leave his name out of it, but there's another circuit speaker, and me and him, we speak at conferences sometimes together, and we have a little bit of a debate going on. If he's Friday night and I'm Saturday night or whatever, vice versa. You know, he says he hates when people say they're a good drinker. Well, too bad is my message to him. Too bad. I'm a good drinker, right? I know what a good drinker is where I come from. I know how a good drinker is defined. First of all, good drinkers hate AA. Never want to come to AA. That's a very good sign of a good drinker. Second of all, good drinkers, the first drink doesn't get you drunk. You know, I'm a guy who told my probation officer when I was like 16 that if I could just stay away from the first shot after the eighth beer, I would be fine. Right? If I could just stick to eight beers at that party at some so-and-so's, you know, parents' house, I would be fine. I didn't realize that I lost the power of choice once I start drinking. You know, and listen, if you're new, I'm just going to tell you, there's a lot of places not to take advice. Medical advice, legal advice, financial advice. AA would be one of those places, okay? What we have here is the power to share with you of how to get sober and live a sober life through the 12 steps. I chose to get advice on living at places like probation offices, DWI school, to the other people that I ran into there. And most of the time when I round up at those places, I was the youngest by 10 or 15 years, always. First time I went to DWI school, the next person to me, I was 16, was 31. And he told me that my problem was what I was drinking. which no one had ever told me before. He introduced me to a thing called white wine spritzers. I don't know if you ever heard of them. I never heard of them before, and I'm dating myself. This is before Bartles and James came up with their own let's sell a wine cooler. This is just white wine and ginger ale or white wine and 7-Up or whatever. But you know what I found out? I can drink like 40 of them, right? That's what I found out, right? And I have a horrible headache the next day. That's what I found out. Not really good advice. You know, I had a lawyer tell me for my second DWI, still a teenager, who told me, you know, when you're the driver, just smoke weed that night, you know? They don't lock up the people who are smoking weed and driving. They go after the drunks. You know, so I'll take advice from anybody who their advice includes that I get to keep partying. If your advice includes that I get to keep partying, you're on my list of go-to people. And I told you where I grew up, and I told you how those parties ended. You know, my dad was an undercover narcotics agent. My mom was an at-home wife. My dad was, he's passed away, he died of this disease. But he was an out-of-control, alcoholic, violent maniac from the time I knew him. But he was my hero. My mom was like this codependent, Al-Anon, untreated, just make everything look good and everything will be okay. And my dad raised me from a young age to believe that as long as you don't do drugs, things are good. You know? Just don't do drugs. They drink, they drug, we drink. And so that was put into my head at a young age. But I'll tell you, if you believe in simple math that 2 and 2 is 4, then what I witnessed as a child would equal that I wouldn't drink. Because I know that what I witnessed in my house and my cousin's house and all other places was bad. That doesn't make me alcoholic. It's not an excuse for being alcoholic. In fact, there are other people that were raised in that house. My sister is not an alcoholic. She saw actually more of the insanity. I passed out for a lot of it. But my dad was a drinker's drinker. My dad taught me about life. If I wanted to spend time with my dad, I either had to be at a softball game or a bar after or before the game. That's where I could see my dad. And I learned a lot of things in those bars. You know, I always joke around, you know, by the time I went to drink in a bar, my other friends who were 16 and 17, they were not trained bar drinkers. It's not that my dad lined up shots for me, but I knew what went on in bars. I knew my dad never went to an ATM or a bank. Never saw my dad. I try to think about it all the time. And I'm the sibling that spent the most time with my dad. I never, ever went to an ATM or a bank with him that I can remember. That was outside of his world. I remember going to work to pick up a paycheck with him. And then I remember because it was cool. Because when your dad's an undercover narc, you go in a special entrance down the street, and then you go down the stairs, and then there's a tunnel that leads over to the building, and so that the undercovers don't ever go in that law enforcement building. And so it was cool to go to work with my dad, and, you know, my dad was a cool guy for all intents and purposes, you know. Some days he came home, and he was dressed like a New York telephone repair guy with a New York telephone repair truck. Some days he came home in a Corvette with a leisure suit on, like a 70s disco leisure suit, you know. You never knew which one you were getting, and he was the toughest guy I ever ran into. You know, he got in fights wherever he went. And I'm not talking about yelling matches, like fights. And so I knew that we left his office and we went to his favorite bar, where he signed the check on the bar and gave it to the bartender. And the bartender gave him his money and paid his tab. First took his tab out, then gave him the balance. And then I remember my dad would always tell me, this is my money and this is the money I give your mom. So like I knew, you know, he lived in this world and, you know, then he would go to other bars and pay off his tab there. And so he banked in Irish bars in New York. That's how he banked. And, you know, he had his own view of the world that is not in the first 164 pages of the big book, for sure. You know, I tell the story all the time. When I was in fifth grade, I got beat up by three guys pretty bad. And, you know, I can't even remember what it was about. Chances are I could have deserved it. I don't know. But I remember when I got home, I was in pretty bad shape, and my mom sat me down and said, "We're going right to the principal's office tomorrow, and we're going to get those kids and their parents are going to get brought in, and we're going to settle this." And what do you say to your mom? Okay. Until my dad came home like 3 hours later. And my dad never came straight home. So let me just, any story that involves my dad meant that wherever he came from, there was an abbreviated stop in the middle at some Irish bar. And so when my dad came home and my mom told him what happened, he sat me down and said, "There's no way your mom is taking you to the principal's office tomorrow. We just don't do that. Like, you're going to forget about this for a couple of weeks. You're just going to let it go. And then a couple of weeks from now, you're going to get one of those guys alone and settle this the way we settle things." And he said, "And if he kicks your ass, you let it go again. And then the next time you hit him when he's not looking." But we do not go to the principal's office. Like, that's just not how we roll. And so, you know, and I so believe in AA's singleness of purpose, but how does drugs interfere in my story? Well, I'll tell you, I don't have drugs in my story, but I'll tell you why. See, when your dad winds up running the local drug task force, a couple of times a year, there's parties in your backyard of all the undercovers. And when you have half a brain and you take a look at what's going on in your backyard, you take a look around there and you're like, "Oh my God." Like, we're not talking about the plainclothes cop who's in some unmarked car. They're easy to spot. We're talking about the undercovers who are between like 21 and 30 years old, who drive vets and New York telephone trucks. In that backyard, there would be the biker narc with the beard down to his chest. There would be the hot female narc who buys cocaine all night in a disco. There would be the preppy narc. There would be, you know, just name whatever else you want, the blue-collar narc. But I remember being that young, and I was already getting in trouble, realizing to myself, like, I need to stay away from anybody that works for my dad. Like, it was bad enough, like, I don't know what they have down here, but in New York, if you're a cop's kid, you get a PBA card, they call it. And you know, that PBA card you put right by your ID so that when somebody asks you for your ID, he or she sees the card and says, "Oh, whose is that?" And you say, "Oh, that's my dad's. Where does he work?" "Oh, he works in narcotics." And then supposedly lets you go. Well, that has worked well for my other three siblings. Not so well for me. I've had a few of them burned in the woods by a cop. I've had one thrown in a sewer, pulled over on the side of the road. Cop just took my card and threw it in the sewer. I don't have a PBA card. My siblings have always had them. But I was, because I don't remember going anywhere with my dad without drinking. Even when I was taught to drive, my dad said, "Pull around to the deli," sent me in to get him a couple of cigars and two tall boy Schaefers. I moved over to the driver's seat. And that's how I was taught to drive. But, you know, for me, what's really important is, so I'm not going to talk about my first drink, because in my family, I don't even know how I could identify my first drink. I know at all those family parties, the men and women really never talked. The men all gambled and watched games on Christmas and Thanksgiving, played poker. All of them ended bad. In my family, a woman does not ask a man for his keys in front of other people. And I know that sounds horrible, but I'm just trying to be honest. Like, you don't disrespect your husband like that in front of other people. I already told you that basically I came here a racist, a bigot, homophobic, anti-Semitic, whole bunch of other things. The only exception in my family to that is if you have the credentials of an undercover narcotics agent. Then you're in our backyard. Then it doesn't matter who you are. because you belong to my dad's ultimate club. But other than that, we don't really associate with different people. And, you know, I mean, I've been going to baseball games and football games with my dad and other things and sipping beer here and splitting a Schaefer there. But when I talk about drinking, I'm talking about being in the woods at 13 years old and getting my first 8-pack of the small Miller bottles, and which led to my second 8-pack. That's my defining moment of drinking, the way we look at drinking. And, you know, we throw around the word progression a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not a word that I really like too much, because I'm a person who, to my core, believes in what the doctor's opinion says. You're either alcoholic or you're not. It's like being pregnant. There might be different types of alcoholics, but there's not different degrees. And, you know, that night, you know, if I had progression, then what would my progression be? When I was in ninth grade, the only thing I thought about on a Monday morning was, where am I going to drink on Friday night? Who has fake ID? Whose parents are going away? But by the time I was in 10th grade, the only thing I thought about on a Monday morning was, I can't make it to Friday night like everybody else. Like everybody else, they're going to go to school all week. They're just looking forward to Friday, some even Saturday. They don't even need to drink on Friday night. Whereas I knew I couldn't make it to Wednesday. And by the time I was in 11th and 12th grade, I rarely went to school on a Monday morning, to be perfectly honest. My mom got captured by the cult, you could say. She wound up in the worldwide family groups of Al-Anon family groups. You know, they teach some things over there that they don't teach here. You know, here we're so accepting. You know, the great thing, if you're new, about Alcoholics Anonymous is, the worse you are, the more we love you, right? The bigger disaster you are, welcome. You know, we have a seat for you. They teach some other things over there. You know, I used to hear a lady in New York say, your program teaches the tools and we have the weapons to deal with the people like you. And my mom learned a few of those weapons or tools. My mom learned that the house was going to have hours. What did that mean? I mean, you're 16 years old and your mom comes up with some stupid idea. And she says, no, you know, like a store, when the store closes, you just can't come in at any hour. You know, like when the house closes at 11 or midnight, whatever time you have to be home, like, it's closed. Come back at 8 the next morning. But I'd rather sleep in the snow and the cold than come back the next morning or get home on time. You know, I don't know how it is to get arrested today, but, you know, I love these wood podiums because in the good old days, they actually had real ink. And when you got processed, you would come into a room with a podium like this. And they would unhandcuff one of your hands, and there would be a metal clip on the end of the podium, and that held the fingerprint card down. And then they would squirt out some ink right up in this section, and they would roll it. And then they would take your hands, and they would take your fingerprints one at a time. I mean, if you've been fingerprint, you know, I always say it's kind of a test when you go for a job that requires fingerprints. Act like you'd never been fingerprinted before, you know? Because the people who do that know if you've been fingerprinted. I was laughing because I just got fingerprinted at the airport for the speedy access, you know, and it's so funny that it's still such ingrained in your head. One finger at a time, which finger goes first, roll them all the way, then they do four fingers, then they take the thumbs. I mean, it's crazy. But, you know, in those old days when I would get processed, you know, like the first time I got arrested for DWI, the cop said, you know, you shouldn't have blown a .25 and be able to talk to me. And I'm like saying, you know, like, I'm the guy who gets everybody home. You know, like, I'm the guy who doesn't pass out. I'm the guy who goes all night. I'm the next day puke guy, you know? But, you know, I think about those times that I've had those conversations. You know, I'm a guy who basically loses control of almost every muscle in my body at 3 in the morning, except for my mouth, which is a dangerous combination. That leads to a lot of problems, a lot of long nights followed by longer weeks of recovery. But my drinking, I've had this allergy since that day in the woods. And once I light it, I can't put it out. And like I told you, once it is out, I then start feeling uncomfortable in my own skin. And, you know, I'll tell you a couple of other things that... So when I was in fifth grade, and you might think, this is random, but I'm going to tell you, it's helped me understand a lot of things. So when I was in fifth grade, at the end of the school year, there was an extra credit question on the test. And I answered it. And whether it was a day or two later, I forget what that is, but the teacher asked to talk to me after class. And she said, how did you get that right? She said, I've been asking that question for years. No one gets that right. And I said, well, last October, you were in the front of the room, and we were talking about that subject, and on the right-hand side of the board, like 12 inches down, right in the corner, you had written the answer, and I could see it. And I remember her telling me, wow, you have a really good memory. You have like a photographic memory, which I did not know what that meant at the time. But soon, you know, the next year or two, when I was getting ready to go to junior high, I would get called into these meetings with my mom and my counselor. And they would say, wow, you know, your test scores are off the charts, but you do not behave well in class. And you don't do homework. You don't take notes. But, like, I had already figured out in my own brain that I didn't need to do homework. I didn't need to take notes. I did not need to do the things that other people do. I just needed to read it once or hear it. And I would just, my plan was to just ace tests. So to tell you how good that plan worked, in a graduating class of like 400 and something people, where I got the third highest score on the SATs, I did not graduate on time. Now, how does that make sense? Only in AA does that make perfect sense, right? In the rest of the world, they can't comprehend that. It's like when I tell people that I got a DWI before I had a driver's license. In the regular world, they have this look of like horror. Like, does that mean you drove before you had a driver's license? You know, like, the rest of the world has a different view of society than we do. Because my view is, you waited until you had a driver's license to drive? Like, I have a much different view of that. And, you know, I think about that because I stayed with that plan for a long, long time. I did not do any work. I did not study. I just aced tests and thought that that would get me through life. And I started getting into a lot of trouble. My trouble is I was recently fingerprinted another time 2 years ago for a license I needed in Georgia for my job. And they weren't as happy as the people at the airport, I can tell you. They were very interested in the paper that came out of the printer that documented for them clearly where I had been on certain days of ages. In New York, the age of an adult is 17. So from age 17 to 23, they had like 12 pages where they knew clearly where I was and what other people said I did. But the thought of not drinking never, ever, ever crossed my mind. I mean, I would do almost anything but not drink. And, you know, I graduated high school, went to community college, finished maybe a couple of classes, but had a job locally, had to set up all 500 folding chairs on the football field at my high school graduation so that I would be able to walk. Like, that was my punishment. You know, when I think about it today, like, the laws are a lot stricter. I think I would have been in a lot more trouble because I was an adult at that time and I had hit a teacher, which I won't brag about. It's a crime, should not happen. It's not behavior I'm proud of, but I hit a teacher. Because I didn't like what he said. But, you know, my dad had kind of instilled in me, you know, I found an old report card when my mom died, and it said, Billy has poor conflict resolution skills. So I think that teacher had a good education in me, for sure. I became a local volunteer firefighter in EMT. EMT school. Drank every night I went to EMT school. Read the book, watched what they did in class, delivered a baby when I was 22 years old, was a successful fireman and EMT, except for my off-duty behavior, because I don't know how to behave. Got arrested a lot of times. The last time, not technically the last time if you include warrants, but the last time that I was actually had committed a crime, had a car accident that someone else did not walk away from. And that doesn't make me an alcoholic. That came with a lot of guilt and shame and remorse, but doesn't make me an alcoholic. Came with a lot of consequences, for sure. Lost my license for 7 years. Had my, you know, I was on jury duty about 2 years ago in New Jersey. And for those of you that have been through the criminal justice system, you know that in every courthouse there's a coffee shop. And in every coffee shop there's basically two groups of people. There's the men and women who are at divorce court with their attorneys. You can pick them out a mile away because they're all pissed off and angry, and the judges ordered them to go to the coffee shop. And then there's the criminal defendants, where their lawyer sits them down and says that they have conferenced this case with the prosecutor and they've decided what's best for me. And, you know, that conversation did not go well. You know, my lawyer told me that the judge had had it with me. I didn't know about violations of probation until I got to be like 19 or 20 years old. But I didn't realize that when I went on probation, I was making a promise to the judge that I would stay out of trouble. I just thought probation was a way to not go to jail. I mean, today I would tell anyone, if you're still drinking, take the jail time. Get it behind you. Because people like us and me, we don't probate well. If I'm still drinking, I am not a model probationer. And I realize today they have these fancy computers, which, I mean, I can't even imagine. Back in the day, my enemy was the radio. That the cop would pull me over, take my license if I had it on me or if I had it, go back to the car, talk to somebody, tell them my name and my date of birth, and then that person usually told the cop that there was something I failed to do, like show up for probation, or I had an outstanding warrant from court, and I would wound up getting arrested, not really for what I did, but for violating the promise I made to the judge in the last year. And, you know, my lawyer told me, and I wanted to try the case, actually. And the other thing I would say is if there's someone here who has lost someone to a drunk driver, or had someone hurt, I always say, I don't expect you to like me, respect me. Like, that's just a fact of my story. I don't make jokes about drunken people who drink and drive. I realize how serious it is. I don't care if you're an alcoholic or not. You should not drink and drive. But my lawyer told me that there was a deal on the table, and if I did not take the deal, he told me the judge was going to give me what is called a tax, a jury tax. I had never heard that term before. And he told me that's when the judge feels you're wasting him and everybody else's time. There is no doubt that you did what you're accused of. But if you waste his time and a jury's time of all that effort, you will get the maximum. And so after that was explained to me, we decided to take a plea, and by this time I was, I don't know, 4 months sober. So, you know, my high school yearbook says that Billy N. will have broken every bone and torn every muscle and ligament in his body, and St. John's Hospital will dedicate a wing to Billy N. Those were the I predict in 20 years predictions about me. No becoming president, no playing third base for the Yankees. So I stand here today, I have no spleen, I have no left kidney, my ribs have been busted so many times, stitches because I just don't know how to shut my mouth. But I wound up coming to AA after that accident, out on bail, and you know what, no one in AA told me you've been wasting our time for the last 8 years. There was one guy who is important to my story because when I was 17 years old outside a church on Long Island, he pulled me aside and looked right at me and said, you know, Billy, you're a pretty nice kid, but unfortunately you might be too cool to get sober. And I didn't know what that meant. today I know what too cool to be sober looks like. When you've been too cool to be sober, you can recognize it from across the room. Whenever I'm bothered in a meeting, it's usually because there's someone who's too cool to be sober there. Because too cool to be sober is so cool, everybody else can see it. That's how cool it is. It usually means that I'm on time for nothing. It usually means that, well, I'm on time for sober softball, but other than that, I'm on time for nothing. It usually means that I'm loud when I come in late. It usually means that I need to shake hands, high five. It usually means that when I go out to the meeting after the meeting, I sit with the cool people. You know, the cool people like to say things like time doesn't matter. Whereas I'm sitting at a table where if you added up the 10 of our sobriety and multiplied it by 10, you still wouldn't have a year. But I'm going to say time doesn't matter. And worse than that, because I am a bully's bully, there's going to be another table in that diner. A table that John Shires would sit at. Let's just call him out tonight. And I'm going to look at that table, and boy, am I going to make fun of them. And boy, am I going to say, there is no way I will ever be like those losers. And the worst part of their whole life is that it's all around AA. Their whole pathetic existence is AA. So that's me at 17 years old, just to get really in the right frame. So when I had to come back, which I was coming back all the time, you know, when I went to my first anniversary meeting, I say it all the time, was in a room like this, except in a basement, with one of those cut-out windows that churches always have between the kitchen and the meeting room. I always heard people talk about the last Friday night of the month. Heard them say, can't wait to go to anniversary meeting this month. So when I was like 16, I said, you know, I'm going to try that anniversary meeting. Now, I was so cool, I wouldn't even let my mom drop me off at the meeting. She would have to pull like 100 feet back. You know, I'm not going to get out of my mom's car. But I went to that anniversary meeting, and I remember they turned the lights down halfway, and like this old lady, like maybe she was 35, you know, I was 16, and they turned the lights down halfway, and they had a sheet cake with candles on it, and they all sang happy anniversary. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, like 26, 36, 46, 56, like even if I live 40 years, this is it. The last Friday night of the month, big anniversary night with the old lady with the candles, like, I had a lot more thoughts to myself, you know? I hadn't been to an outdoor heavy metal rock concert yet, you know? I hadn't been to the right field bleachers of Yankee Stadium without my dad. I hadn't been to a Rangers Islander game and gotten to a fight with Islander fans, you know? I hadn't gone to enough St. Pat, you know, in my teenage years, just so we know about what today would have looked like. Today I would have gotten up at about 5:30 in the morning, which I told you is unusual. But I would have gotten up at 5:30 in the morning today. And I would have met my friends at the Long Island Railroad Station. And we would have a couple of cases of beer. We would drink all the way into New York City. We would go to the parade all day. We would try to go to Beefsteak Charlie's at Penn Station at Madison Square Garden because they had all the beer, wine, and sangria you can drink with our fake ID that we bought in Times Square. And then ride the trains home and, like, climb on them as they're moving. Like, that's what my St. Patrick's Day would look like for many years. But the people of AA didn't hold any of that against me. In fact, there's a significant event in my first month and a half of sobriety that I always talk about. I don't know if anybody remembers, but Mike Tyson fought Buster Douglas. And Buster Douglas was supposed to get killed that night. Mike Tyson was invincible. And that night I went to a meeting and a guy asked me and said, hey, I got like 20 guys coming to my house. We got that or whatever it was on, HBO, pay-per-view, I don't know. We ordered pizza, we're going to play cards. And for whatever reason, I said yes. And I went and saw like 20 men who were laughing and having a good time. And, you know, not soon after that, I was sentenced. And I was such a little punk. I remember the night before I was sentenced, I stayed at my mom's house. And the next morning she drove me to court and she would not come inside. She could not witness her oldest son because this was going to be different than all my other court dates. There was going to be no released on your own recognizance. There was going to be like $5,000 cash bail, or $500 cash bail, $5,000 bond. There's going to be none of that. I was going to show up. I was going to admit to what I did. I'd put my hands behind my back. I'd get handcuffed, brought to the waiting area, then chained to 12 other people or 14 other people, and then walked outside onto a bus and driven 70 miles to where I would live for the next year or so. And, you know, that morning I told my mom, you know, you and Dad should be going to jail. You know, like, that's the reason I'm here. This disastrous house we grew up in, because my parents had a horrible divorce and lots of things that happened. And, you know, inside that correctional facility, thank God there was Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was like 4.5 months sober when I went in. And, you know, I'm not here to take anyone through the steps. I know there are speakers today who believe in an hour they can take someone through the steps, but I would tell you to run as fast as you can from them and to find somebody who can take you through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But inside my correctional facility, there was AA, and I got moved to a minimum after I was in like 4.5 months. Now, I'll tell you that I didn't like minimum. If I ever was to get sentenced again, I would want to be in a maximum custody penitentiary because, again, it's not a good psychiatric report about my own mental health, but I do better with another person in a cell with a small day area in the front where our 10 cells can hang out and watch TV. I'm not a good guy to lock up in a dormitory like this room with 100 other guys. My temper, my temperament, my mentality, I don't do well in that. But what was good about minimum is they had AA too, and they had more AA. And I was working as a cook during the day and a GED tutor at night, and I could go to meetings 2 or 3 days a week when they were. And I started listening to speaker tapes. And I listened to a tape. I won't name the speaker, but he said something that pissed me off because he said sobriety time in custody doesn't count. Well, for those of us that have had an address of a correctional facility, you know, I can assure you, I'm not judging, but I can tell you anyone that thinks it's easy to stay sober locked up has just never been locked up for a good amount of time. And to have this person say, so when I went back the next week, and I brought the cassette back, and I'm dating myself, I had a Walkman that had no AM, FM, because that interfered with the guards' radios, just a cassette. Hammer Time was a big song at the time. You know, old school hip-hop, I have still a good memory, all the old school hip-hop from like 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93. But I threw that tape back, and for whatever reason, I grabbed another tape. And it said, Tom I, Aberdeen, North Carolina. And it was a man who was 30-something years sober who had killed 2 people drinking and driving and was now the warden of a maximum custody penitentiary in North Carolina. And boy, did I hold on to his hope for months. To the point when I got out, I finally tracked him down. And Tom is very sick and ill these days. But I remember the time I called him. I remember when I called him and said, Mr., I won't say his last name. I said, I just want to, you know, we're talking no cell phones. I called his office. A secretary answered. And because I had met a taper, and I said, how do I get in touch with that guy? And he gave me his number. And I said, you know, I just wanted to call and thank you for saving my life. And he said, I didn't save your life. He said, AA saved your life. And don't ever forget that. And you have a debt to repay that never goes away. It doesn't matter if you're a day sober or 100 days sober or 10 years sober or 30 years sober. If you're not paying back that debt, you're being dishonest to the people who helped you. And, you know, when I got out, life wasn't easy. You know, I'll talk about a couple of things before I end, but life was tough. Life was hard. You know, I think about sand ashtrays in New York City because I had convinced the probation department to let me transfer to New York City. because at least I could take the subway there and have the buses. And, you know, cigarettes in sand ashtrays light better than ones that were stepped out by someone getting on a subway. I don't know if you know that, but if you learn nothing tonight, I can teach you that if you are happen to be homeless, even though now you can't smoke inside hotels, but in the good old days, the rich hotels had these sand ashtrays near the elevators. And they even like had a thing that like puts the symbol of their hotel in the sand. And somebody had that job. And rich people who get on these elevators would put their cigarette in the sand ashtray before they went upstairs. So, you know, I learned that those were easier to light than people who were getting on the subway. I learned that I could make it through a day with basically a pack of Newports and a slice of pizza, but if I didn't have enough money, just Newports and coffee, you know, that I could get by without food that day. I became an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York City, and I'm defining active member as I got a home group, I got a sponsor, I got some commitments, I got active in a young people's committee, played a lot of sober softball. My sponsor encouraged me to go back to college, 3 credits at a time, which took me like 15 years to finish. But I remember looking at me and saying, well, you're going to be 40 unless you're dead, but let's just say you're not. You can be 40 years old with a college degree or without, even if it takes you that long. He taught me how to tip. Not allowed to eat out unless I have enough money to tip the waitress. Like, that's the new rule. I didn't know that rule. Nobody taught me that rule. I didn't know about that rule. About 2 years after I got out, I was still very judgmental. My sponsor told me about this thing called the Joe and Charlie Workshop. And it was these two guys that took people through the Big Book, which sounded horrendous to me, I must admit. And he made me give him like $2 a week. You know, because I'm talking like, I didn't have a checking account. I cashed my check at a check cashing place. I lived in a single room occupancy hotel. I got money orders to pay my bills. And he made me pay him like $2 a week for this stupid thing. And this stupid thing finally arrived. It was at the Marriott Marquis in New York City. And I remember that Friday night. I'm sure some people here have been to a Joe and Charlie weekend. It usually started on Friday night, all day Saturday, half a Sunday. So I remember showing up at this thing, and you know who was there? Everybody I hated in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every single person that I hated. Like, if I had an AA nightmare, this Joe and Charlie thing was my nightmare. And, like, you're talking about the people that, like, had notebooks with them and highlighters and different color highlighters, and the real lunatics had, like, a 1939 dictionary so they could look up the words, what it meant back then. Like, I'm talking about everybody I hated, and Alcoholics Anonymous was there. But I can tell you, over that weekend, Joe and Charlie hooked me. And what they hooked me on was the disease of alcoholism. That we have an allergy. That I cannot safely drink. What they hooked me on was the doctor's opinion and more about alcoholism. That people like me, I'll try everything, including 40 white wine spritzers. I'll try anything not to drink. As long as I still get to drink a little bit. Like, that's my little rule there. They reined me in that no matter how bad the consequences are the night before, the week before, the year before, for real alcoholics, that does not stop us from drinking. In fact, I know we all know a lot of people who have died from this disease, but I'm more scared by the people who don't die. We all know them. You probably see them in your meetings. You can't believe they drank again and are still alive. Like, if I had special forces, if I ever was the president, I'd want alcoholics, because some of us you just cannot kill. Like we will keep coming back. After Joe and Charlie, I got myself a Big Book home group. I was active in service. I was a GSR at the time, I think, of the Westside Young People's Group. Probably about a year after that, I started feeling like I was at these service assemblies and no one from the big book groups was there. But then I was at the big book groups and it seemed they wouldn't know a tradition if they walked into it. So I was, same taper who gave me Tom I's phone number, I went to him and said, is there somebody who's like both into the big book and loves service? And he said, yeah, there's a guy named Don P. from Aurora, Colorado. He's currently, or he had just finished being the U.S. trustee at large on the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he gave me his phone number. And I remember when I called him the first time. And it's a small world because Tom I had helped Don P. I mean, it's amazing. I don't know if there's any AA historians in the audience, but we lost one of our best ones last week. Mel B. from Toledo, Ohio, passed away. Mel B. was 60-something years sober. He wrote the book, Pass It On, for the AA office. But what's interesting is Mel B. was the speaker who got brought in from the outside at Tom I's second meeting in prison at Jackson Penitentiary in Michigan. And Don P. told me how Tom had helped him and got him into the corrections world of AA. And, you know, I started, you know, it's hard to believe Don's gone as long as he is, but, you know, I stayed involved in service, and I stayed involved in always having a big book home group, and I stayed involved with the Young People's Convention. It's interesting that I look at where I am in my career today, and the International Conference of Young People in AA was at the New York Marriott Marquis, where I went to the Joe and Charlie workshop a year before. I worked on that committee for a year, so for those of you who are on the Atlanta Roundup Committee, I want to thank you for your service. I always tell people in service and on convention committees that the one thing I know about AA is that, you know, when you show up at your convention this year, you will meet a lot of other people who have done no work but will tell you what you could have done better. That's just the nature of AA service. No effort, but a lot of advice. It's classic. After that Young People's Conference, I had become close to the manager of that hotel who offered me a job. And I finished going to school working for him. And then a year later, there was a job at that company's corporate office open. And I applied for it, and I got it. And I had to move to Chicago. But I think about, like, you know, seconds and inches, all the things that have happened. You know, I became the GSR of the crazy West Side Young People's Group in 1993. And at least for another month, today I'm the chair of the AA World Services Board. That's kind of insane, right? I sit as a Class B trustee on the General Service Board. I have for the last 4 years, and the 4 years before that was a director on the AA World Services Board. And you know, I'll end by saying this, that I have lots of concerns. I love AA. But I know there's lots of problems going on in the world. One of the things that breaks my heart is obviously there's a huge problem with opiates in this country today and in the world. But one of the hardest things for me to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous was to check my ego. And that's what I was taught. You know, I'm not going to sentence a drug addict to die in Alcoholics Anonymous because I've just seen it happen too many times. Now, if the person happens to be an alcoholic and something else, then welcome to the club. I've not met an AA member who has no other problems. If there's one here, I would love you to tell me that after this meeting. I meet AA members with gambling problems, relationship problems, sex problems, drug problems, all kinds of things. But what keeps us here and keeps us united is that we suffer from alcoholism. And it breaks my heart sometimes when I talk to a young kid who tells me that they've never had a problem with drinking, but someone told them to go to AA. Because we're the magic potion, or we've been doing it the longest, or the other fellowships are not as good. Well, I've spent a lot of time helping other people create other meetings and other fellowships. I want them. Bill W. wanted everybody to have our solution. But I'm not going to tell someone who doesn't have a problem with drinking. I'm not going to let my ego say that I can help them. You know, and I'm glad that I was taught that a long time ago. You know, I'm going to close at one story. Because, you know, everybody has their gift in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's an old speaker named Cliff R. He doesn't travel as much as he used to, but he was a great speaker. And he used to always say that everybody in AA has a gift. And the only crime in AA is not finding out what your gift is. There are some people who are awesome at answering the phones at the central office. They could talk somebody off a ledge and get them to a meeting better than anybody. There are people who can work miracles in a car or at a diner or a Friendly's or a Zaxby's across a table from somebody else. There are other people who are great sponsors, great treasurers. We need all of them. Every last one of them. The only crime is not really, you know, knowing what you're good at. And people talk about sometimes the money. I mean, thank God Alcoholics Anonymous is poor. Thank God. That's what's kept us safe. Money has been the evil and corroding thread of Alcoholics Anonymous since it started. I can tell you, as the chair of the board that looks at our pension fund and looks at our reserve fund, I mean, what other organization, once they get close to 12 months of prudent reserve, decides we need to cut the cost of literature? We can't have too much money. Only we do that. I flew next to the chair of the board of a very large nonprofit that you would recognize, and we started talking, and I talked to him about the board that I was on, and he spends 80% of his time fundraising. I spend 0% of my time fundraising, because we only take money from our members. You can go on AA.org tonight and set up a recurring contribution now of like $5 a month if you want. We only take from our members. But sometimes people ask me about, you know, one of the things that drives me crazy is we talk about, I love AA history, but I hate the AA history that makes it sound like miracles stopped on Mother's Day 1935. Miracles have been happening every day since Mother's Day 1935. If there's one thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that today and tonight, somebody went to their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous around the world. And I know that some of those people who went to their first meeting today, a year from now, will celebrate at one of those crazy anniversary meetings I talked about. And before they even say their name and say they're an alcoholic, their family members will be in tears, looking at what an organization that has no money and no love like the parents or the spouses do was able to heal someone that all the money and all the love couldn't fix John or Jane anymore. So they were dropped off at the last house on the block we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, but I also am honest enough to know another group of people woke up today, unfortunately. And those people's lives were dramatically changed yesterday or last night. And some of those family members won't even ever see that family member again. Some of those families' lives have been devastated last night and this morning, and it'll never change. Like, I'm very aware of how real this disease is. So when people talk about service and the Atlanta Roundup and all this other stuff, and I hear people say, well, that stuff is just politics, I'll watch my language, but that is ridiculous. It is so ridiculous, it's hard for me. I could do a 7-day workshop on it. So I'll just give you one story to remember of how powerful it is when you even put a penny in your basket. You know, in 1983, I want to say, a group of Marines deployed to an airport in Beirut. Those Marines stayed in a very hostile area. One of those Marines was a young man named Jay. Jay was from North Carolina, newly sober, and wound up in that combat area. Jay wrote the General Service Office and let them know that because they would he couldn't take a lot of personal equipment or stuff with him, he had no literature. And so he wrote through the Armed Forces mail, and the office sent him a big book and a letter. And Jay wrote back a month later thanking them for that letter. And I've actually seen those letters. And Jay said, whatever you can send me, please send me. I just want to stay sober. And so they sent him a whole new basket of literature. And he wrote back a month later and said he had good news to report, kind of like a term out of our big book that Bill uses, good news. He said he wanted to let the office know that he had started the Peacekeepers group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they met in between the shelling and the fighting, and it was a couple of Marines and a couple of locals. And so they sent him more literature, and he wrote back one more time and said, please send more. And a couple of months went by with no letter from Jay until a woman wrote the office in December of that year and said she had the heart-wrenching job of letting them know that the young Marine they had been writing to had been killed in the bombing with the other 270-something Marines in October of that year. But that the good news she wanted to report was that there was the Peacekeepers group still met. And I tell that story because today everyone has a smartphone with them. And what you can do tonight is you can Google Alcoholics Anonymous in Lebanon, and you will see that on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturday nights at 8:30, there is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because a young Marine who thought he might drink asked for some literature, and a couple of generous people in groups in 1979 and 80 put money in the basket, and the group had a couple extra dollars. And so when the woman at the office got that letter, she was able to send Jay a big book and whatever other literature he wanted. But those things go on every day. We just don't talk about them sometimes. Because the last thing I'll tell you is my favorite guy that ever visited the office. I just went to my last board meeting. I have one more, but it won't be at the office. But I always sit on the window side facing the door. And if you've not been to the General Service Office, when you get off the elevator on the 11th floor, you will see first the Serenity Prayer in a whole bunch of different languages. And I love catching the people as they turn the corner because I can tell who's never been there before because the tears in their eyes are unbelievable. And they've made a pilgrimage to come see the archives and go to the meeting there. But my favorite guy ever who visited was a couple of years ago who showed up at the front desk and the receptionist asked if she could help him. And he took a letter out of his back pocket. And he said, yeah, he said, you know, I got this letter when I was in prison in 1998. And I was trying to stay sober, and I wrote, and I asked for a big book, and this guy, Doug, sent me a letter. And in the last paragraph of the letter, he said, hey, if you ever get out, and you happen to be in New York, please stop by and say hello. And the guy said to the receptionist, that's what I came here for today. I'm not on parole anymore. I'm allowed to come out of the state, and I wanted to come and say hello to this guy. So, you know, everything we do, I know that some people get bored of service, as I do sometimes, because we want to make it about guidelines and rules, when there's only one purpose of the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is to make sure that those who are not here today come to AA, and that AA is here like it was for us, and our sacred duty is just to let them find the same AA that we found. No different, no better, no worse. Just to have the doors open, an uncomfortable chair, a bad cup of coffee, and a little bit of compassion, and to welcome somebody to the greatest day of the rest of their life. So it's really an honor and a privilege to be here tonight, and I look forward to being at the Atlanta Roundup this year. Thank you very much.